Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of 8 cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
I'm Dave Simonette, singer, songwriter, guitar player for Trampled by Turtles. I am at home in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Never really thought about what I'm trying to do with my art, I guess. It's just to make it is really the end goal there.
Hold out in a blackboard autumn. Sit down right where you want. High tide on a yellow morning. Beside, ooh, all the good times are gone.
20 years in, Trampled by Turtles. I mean, that's it's a pretty impressive feat if you break it down.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like we are all, I think, very proud of that one. I mean, we also shouldn't jinx it because we have a few months until that actually happens. But on the verge of it is enough for me. Yeah, it's, you know, of all the things that can stop a band from staying together. And you know, we've kind of so far successfully swerved around all those things. So feel very lucky, man, for sure.
All the good times are gone.
Thanks for being with us. You're tuned into The Show on the Road, my music discovery podcast where we get to talk to some of the greatest artists and songwriters of our time. And Dave Simonette has been making music with Trampled by Turtles up in Minnesota for over 20 years. And as a fellow songwriter, I am amazed at his longevity, at his passion, and honestly, at his perseverance. Do you know anybody who's been working the same job day after day, week after week, and actually getting better as they go along for 20 straight years? I doubt it. And as we'll talk about in this episode, their new record, Alpenglow, was created with one of the great Americana rock and roll masters of our time, Jeff Tweedy. So I'm really excited for you to hear this music. The other thing I'm really excited about is that a lot of people, young people especially, went out and voted yesterday. I record this the day after the midterm election day happened, and it felt momentous, like maybe we could actually dig ourselves out of this big hole that we've created. And I don't know about you, but I've been dealing with a lot of existential dread and wondering where my place in this country is right now, whether my voice matters at all right now, not just as a songwriter, but as a human being, as a citizen. And my hope is, honestly, that more artists, songwriters, bands can start using their microphones for good, getting the word out about what's right and what's wrong. Okay, without further ado, here he is now, Dave Simonette of Trampled by Turtles. And can you introduce, even though they're not there, but spiritually, yeah, they're here with us, your bandmates and what they do?
Yeah, sure. We'll start on stage left. It's Eamon McLean is the cello player. Tim Saxhog is the bass player. Dave Carroll is our banjo player. Ryan Young is our fiddle player. And Eric Berry is our mandolin player.
Did you imagine as a kid that you'd be playing music full time? Was there a moment where you're like, oh, I think I could really do this? Or was it a total pipe dream?
I did imagine that. I can really remember it starting maybe seventh to eighth grade. I had a friend that played guitar, and I became really obsessed with learning how to do that. And it took me a couple of years before I ended up doing it. But, it, you know, all through early high school, it's all I want. Even before I could play music or written a song or anything, it's really what I wanted to do. I didn't really, thankfully, now that I look back on it, I never really had anybody tell me it wasn't realistic at the time. So it felt like just something that anybody could pick up and do, which I've kind of always kept that attitude that it's very realistic to do that if you work hard enough at it, so to speak. But it's all I can, but my dream job that I can remember before playing music was to be a professional baseball player. And that was when I was really young. So it's been my dream for a long time.
Whittle like a mousetrap, queen of the sky, oh, tell me I'm forgiven. Simulated pilgrims, why oh why won't they take me with them? Sell me something bright and shinier than I can imagine. Parting ways, those summer days, so happy to have had them.
Were you a Twins fan when Kirby Puckett, yeah, and those guys were crushing it?
Yeah, still a Twins fan, but those were the glory years. You got that right.
As a sad, diehard White Sox fan, we would dread coming to the Metrodome. Every time we went there, our season went to die.
I was a little kid, you know, I'm 42, so I was around for both of our World Series wins in 87 and 91.
Are you from Duluth originally?
No, I grew up in a town called Mankato, Minnesota, kind of like southern Minnesota farm community, a little bit bigger than that maybe. And then I moved to Duluth to attempt to go to college when I was 18, and that I made it through school 1 year and then dropped out and started playing music, but I stayed there for a long time.
As I tell my wife, it seems like truly successful people are all college dropouts. And yet, we will encourage our 8-month-old daughter to definitely finish college.
Yeah, I mean, I'll encourage my kids to do that too, should they decide to go that way. I'm not, you know, I have kind of an, I think you're right, but, it just depends on what that person wants to do. And I all I wanted to do is play music, and I could not find a path through that school that led me to that, you know, in the way that I wanted to do it. And I couldn't, you know, I was trying to visualize going to school for something else and to try to get a career doing something else, which I think is usually the point of going to college. And none of that made sense to me. So, I feel like I'd like to think that I've had that experience. So if my kids feel that way, I'd support them there too.
What is the first release officially by Trampled by Turtles? Is it Songs from a Ghost Town, or is there something earlier?
Yeah, no, Songs from a Ghost Town, 2004.
My brother works for the CIA. I remember listening to that when that came out. And being like, this band is weird, but I kind of like it.
You probably have that too, and you go back and listen to your old stuff, man. It's like you're a different person, you know?
Days go flying by, and I can't wait till you and I are finally home again. Well, there ain't no easy answers when the circus is in town. And troubled juries hang each other dead. And the TV's filled with poets who only write in rhyme. And my brother works for the CIA, he's not doing time.
Because, you know, the Bluegrass Festival circuit, I think, was just blossoming when you guys,
yeah,
started out. And obviously you've played all the biggest venues and festivals around the world that honor the acoustic music tradition. But I think when I listen to your songs, I don't hear like traditional, like Southern bluegrass. Obviously you guys are from up north.
Right.
So there's something that's filtered through a rock and roll lens for me, which makes, I think, total sense having Jeff Tweedy produce your newest record, Album Glow, which comes out at the end of October. Because Jeff, again, for me, is like the godfather of that genreless roots rock and roll, you know, where you can't quite pinpoint what it is, but it just feels timeless, you know.
Sure. Well, that's great. I mean, I think that we, you know, when our band started, it was a side project, really. Most of us that started the band were playing in other bands in town, like rock bands. And this was something that none of us had ever done. None of us had ever been in like an acoustic focused group. And so it was something to do, like a weird thing to do on the side. And I think in the beginning, you know, this was way back in the olden times before like streaming was around. So we would go to the record store and find like these old bluegrass records, folk records and stuff like that, that none of us had ever heard, and learn the songs and play.
Right.
And I think our first couple albums, you know, that was still that. It was like, I'm going to write a bluegrass song, you know. And then once the band became everybody's main focus, which happened fairly early on, we're like, well, as a songwriter anyway, I was like, I don't want to write like I'm a, you know, not me. And I'd rather kind of work with the same material that I would do for a rock band, but do it with this band instead. And so that was kind of the method since then. Like, it didn't have to lyrically or, you know, melody wise, it didn't always have to sound like a string band. It was just like, let's take a song I would have written for any other band and put it in this instrumentation. So I think that just out of like scientific necessity would kind of make us our own thing, you know?
Well, in a way, I think having a base in harder electric music is a way to sort of practice the speed and the agility of this music. Because on one hand, bluegrass and, you know, a lot of American folk music feels accessible. That's why I think a lot of us were able to get into it. We can learn Let the Circle Be Unbroken.
Right.
We can learn these songs that have been around for generations, and it feels like they're like a nice worn-in shoe that you can step into. But once you start creating stuff of your own, you guys just definitely were known for your just raw fury speed, you know, in some of that early stuff. I remember seeing some early videos, you know, and just being like, these guys are like heavy metal acoustic music in a way, you know. It's like bringing those two things together. And you see a guy like Billy Strings, who's obviously risen to the top of this field, you know, grew up playing kind of punk rock, heavy hardcore stuff. You know, the first band I was in Chicago was a punk band, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap there, really, you know, technically, like music, playability kind of stuff. Like, you know, to make it to be simple, I guess it's like they're too like fast. Like, you got to be able to kind of keep up to play in a punk band, or in a like to do that with bluegrass instruments too. I think that we also relied less on like technical proficiency maybe than a guy like Billy, who's just like insanely good as well. You know, he's like, he also doesn't really hit wrong notes, which we got plenty of those.
Yeah.
Ours, I think, was more like energy based than talent, maybe.
Were you surprised when Palomino, the record from 2010, kind of went in a mainstream recognition place?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah.
That was everywhere for a second there.
Yeah, it's relative to us. You know, it's not like it was like wasn't like an Adele record or anything, but it was, for us, it was kind of a major leap out of just our little region into we noticed that kind of stuff based on touring. That's kind of what we always do. So we all of a sudden we were going to places that used to have nobody, and now there were some crowds there, and it was a wonderful time. But absolutely a surprise. We made that record for barely any money, and a bunch of different studios. Most of it was done in our friend Eric Hoskins' studio, which is a great place, but, you know, it's very much like a DIY space. thankfully he's an incredible engineer, so it worked out great. But it was, you know, it was in like a high budget production, and it was, you know, we were still pretty young, and so you know, I think we made like a video that was just us playing a song and that kind of stuff. And so nobody thought, we just never thought that anything like that would happen to our band anyway. So any little thing that did was a surprise, and still is.
When you look at a song like Wait So Long, having close to what, 50 million streams at this point.
I know, it's like approaching like $6.
I mean, you guys got to be set for life with that $6. Yeah. Right. No, but like that's a song that has gotten into a lot of people's consciousness.
Yeah.
For years, you know, and that's it's an impressive feat for an acoustic band, right? I think a lot of times when we're trying to compete with whatever mainstream thing right now, hip hop, pop music, it feels right. Like if you're playing real instruments, it's like you're pushing a rock up a huge mountain. Like you're so far behind. Like how can we compete with Dua Lipa and Beyonce? There's no way, you know. But every now and again, a song like Wait So Long can kind of sneak through the cracks and become, you know, I mean, I guess like you could see like a Mumford and Sons or Lumineers every now and again. I wish there were more bands with real instruments that could have a mainstream recognition more than once every 7 years or something. But like,
well, you know, for a long time that was all there was. And so it's I feel like there's always going to be a space for it, I hope. And I feel like there's kind of a little bit of a pendulum that swings back and forth, you know, like it can go, we're finding whole new landscapes of electronic ways to make music at the moment, which is really cool that people, I feel like people are finding like new ways to be artistic in that space. It's beyond my, you know, it's above my pay grade. I love how accessible it is for kids, especially to start making music now. But then I feel like for every inch you move that way, there's going to be another swing backwards. Like, wow, I wonder what this is like with an instrument that just sounds like something on its own. You know, and the work it takes to learn that format as well. I feel like every time we move towards the electronic, we also move back towards the acoustic as well. It's just like the landscape gets wider and wider, and I feel like it's all great, you know. I think in the end, like a song, if somebody writes a great song that maybe not a great song, but how about like a song that really connects with people in one way or another?
Right.
I think that the instrumentation very much comes second to whether or not that song gets heard by a lot of people.
The opening track of Alkaline Glow, It's So Hard to Hold On, again, very rooted in that string band bass, but I think has that sort of melancholy drive that a lot of my favorite Wilco songs have. Did Jeff sort of encourage songs like that to go in a certain direction, or how did he make his imprint?
Yeah, he did a lot of arranging with us, which was great. It was like, I brought all of the songs in the band. The rest of the band had heard maybe half of them, just some demos I'd sent around, but we hadn't played really any of them together. Well, maybe a couple, but not a lot. You know, like we hadn't really rehearsed much. And so I brought them in pretty raw, but I thought they were done. And then we started recording. I think that was the first one we recorded too. And that one changed a lot. I mean, I think it's about half as long now. Some parts were changed around. He was just really good at like, okay, I like the bass of this, but I'm going to help you make it like more listenable for somebody. Or let's just try, you know, the chord progression is getting a little repetitive. Let's try switching it on the second half of the verse. And he did a lot of that stuff on pretty much every song on the record, which was a great exercise for me because I don't really write with other people. And not out of an opposition to it, really, but more just I just haven't done it that much. And it wasn't, we weren't writing songs together per se, but we were going in and be like, hey, this is, you know, let's just try all of these other versions of the same thing that you're doing. And it was really helpful to me to get out of that box. And I mean, you know how it is. You write songs for a long time, and it's a lot of times, even unconsciously, you fall back into really similar patterns. So it would have, that our album would have sounded a whole lot different without Jeff there.
And you guys recorded this mostly live with no overdubs, right?
Yeah, almost all of it. I sang, I think, everything live.
That's a tightrope walk. I mean, that's a scary walk.
I love recording like that, though. I'm the most, maybe ironically, but I'm the most comfortable in that situation. I feel like when I mean, if I can't get a take singing live, if I'm the one that's messing up every time, then I'll go back and do it. Overdub, but this time that didn't really happen. But we've always, I feel like, worked better that way in the studio, and because we do accept a certain amount of mistake in each in a keep or take. You know what I mean? Like I feel like for us, it's much more important to have the entire thing feel like a cohesive vibe than to have every note be completely perfect. So with that mindset, it's really easy for us to record live. Actually, we play live together. That's how we're best. I play better when I can see the other guys and I can just hear them acoustic, you know, like without headphones on, really. And and Jeff was down to work like that, so it was great. It was, the whole thing was really casual, man. A lot of the songs he's credited with guitar on that record on a bunch of tunes, and that really came from him just kind of like coming out where we were playing and sitting down and just playing with us. And maybe coming up with a cool part to keep or whatever. But he, you know, we were all just kind of sitting around. It was like sitting in a living room.
You mentioned his ability to whittle down versus song structure. And obviously, I think his ability to create an economy of language and sound is something that definitely you could hear on this record, especially the song that he wrote, A Lifetime. To find it's just doing, honestly, what I think John Prine did best too, kind of hitting the nail with one hammer stroke. You know,
yeah.
And like then piercing through real quick, you know.
Yeah, Jeff's great at that. He's a great, I mean, he's, in my opinion, he's one of our great songwriters, you know. And so I trust him when he comes up with this stuff, you know. And most of the ideas he had, we end up keeping in some, if not in the first form, you know, some kind of varied form. He's just kind of intuitive in that way. And it was really helpful for us to do that and just for us to have somebody, like an extra set of ears even. But for him, you know, it's just like, it's the guy that we all respect already. You know, I loved his work for a long time. And so it's easy to take advice from a guy like that, you know.
It takes a lot. Time to find a life like the life you had in mind. It takes a life, time to find a life like the life you had in mind. Now you're mine.
Now, obviously, you're coming on the 20th anniversary of this band's existence, but it could have stopped permanently around 2016, right? I mean, you guys kind of had a hiatus slash full-on breakup depends who you ask, right?
Yeah. I quit the band. I mean, at that time. And it turns out what we really needed was just a break, and that's what we ended up taking. And thankfully, I got some very understanding bandmates that were okay with me kind of crawling back. But we were just touring too much, you know. And as we found, we all kind of, not everybody's breaking point is the same in that way, but I found mine. And it was a lot of stuff going on in my personal life at the time, and then we were just on the road constantly. So life felt very chaotic, and I didn't want to stop playing music, but I just wanted everything to stop and just change. Like, I want to do something else. And it turns out I just needed some space from this thing. And, you know, we took a year and a half away, at least, man, almost 2 years, I guess, away from playing shows and from, like, really even hanging out. And it was, you know, when we decided to come back, we started in the studio instead of going back on the road, kind of gently started coming back to play with each other. And it was honestly better than it had been really our whole career, I think, for me.
And that was that Life is Good on the Open Road?
Yeah.
Which is kind of an ironic name, if you think about it, when you're like, God, I just need to escape this torturous drive throughout Kansas, right, and Nebraska every year. But life is good.
It was me trying to think about it, like change my paradigm a little bit, because getting off of tour, and I toured with another, you know, my other band a lot during that time, but getting off of our tour, there's nothing like some space from it to really make you appreciate it, you know? So I was like, I've been really down on traveling and playing, and I just wanted to be home, and I've been really down on this lifestyle. And then when I took some time away from it, you know, like, it's cliche, but it was like, actually, I miss it. And so let me try to think about this differently. Let's think about the parts of this that I love, you know. And that's where that record kind of came from. I was like, let me think about the freedom that it gives me, and the you know, to be able to work in writing songs and playing songs. I mean, it's an incredibly lucky thing to have. And so I tried to start thinking about it that way, and I think that's where that all came from.
Lying fever ahead in the restless wind in the call in the dying fast like the highest noon. Well, I never learned from nothing. Feather falls the river light. The woman shaking sun. He's older now than ever.
What do you think is the low point, worst show that you can think of with Trampled by Turtles? Like, when people were throwing things at you. Like, what was there? Was there a moment? Was there a specific show? You can totally trash talk a certain city if you want, but like, is there a moment where you're like, maybe I need to question my life choices? Because we all have that one show. Two shows. All
right. Yeah, I have two that for different reasons. The first one being what you're talking about, where the crowd just hated. It was very early. I was booking the band. This was like 2004 or five, maybe. And I was just calling bars. You know, we were like, we want to go to the West Coast. So I was just calling places. Uh-huh. Calling. very different world back then, you know. And we got one of our weird, shitty shows that we got via my talents at booking was like a little like sports bar, and I think it was Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm sorry, people of Corvallis, if that was wrong, but if you've been there, you know, small town,
college town,
yeah. So we played this sports bar, and where we had, I think we even set up our own little PA. And we definitely were running our own sound. I know that. And we're having a lot of trouble with that. And for all of you that tried to run acoustic instruments in a sports bar with some very subpar gear, yeah, a lot of that going on. And people were not happy with it. We're definitely letting us know. And we played a very short set. And I remember being like, yeah, I could go without doing that again. But it wasn't, I didn't want to hang up the Spurs or anything. My second one was much later, and we were playing a very awesome venue. This was the Pageant in St. Louis. I'm right about all that. And one of our first tour back from that break we were just talking about, and that song you were talking about before, Wait So Long, came up out in the middle of the set, and I forgot the entire song of words, of lyrics. And I go up just like playing, go up to sing, and there's nothing there. And it was, it's like my worst fear on stage. And
had you been drinking? Like
on stage and stuff. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Was there like specific?
I was fine to get on stage. It wasn't that. I don't know what happened, man.
Yeah.
I've always been pretty bad at remembering lyrics under the spotlight. And it's kind of like this thing that people that have watched us play a long time probably aren't that surprised. Happens if I forget a verse or something.
Right.
Which happens to everybody, you know, but this time there was just nothing. And we even restarted the song. Like, it was very embarrassing. And finally I just had the crowd sing it and we got through it. But then, I don't know, it was like a mix of humor and for me, I felt horrible. But then the worst part about it was I looked down and we still had like 8 songs to go. And now I'm like, I don't remember any of them. You know, thankfully it came back and whatever black hole I went in, I got out of. But the mind is a tricky little bastard on stage sometimes, man. That was my least favorite performance I've ever had. I would take that Corvallis Oregon shit crowd over that any day.
Well, I always say that lyric memory is sort of like shooting a free throw or like or like bowling. It's like the more you aim, the more you are like, oh god, I have to remember, the less you remember somehow.
That's exactly right.
Whereas it's just muscle memory and free movement of your body.
The problem is it's so hard to get back from that space once the thought enters your mind, though, wherever it comes from. You know, but I'm very conscious of that. I know, like, once I start trying to think about a song before we start playing it, I gotta get out of there real fast, or else it's gonna be a conscious thing the whole time. And there's nothing worse than thinking when you're on stage. You know, it's not where you're supposed to be.
We had a situation on Saturday in Kentucky that I've never had in over 10 years with our band. It was a moonshine festival.
Oh boy, okay.
So there is risk involved. But it was also 37 degrees at showtime somehow in this little holler.
Oh yeah. Dang.
We were playing after Lucinda Williams, which was amazing.
Yeah, that's real cool.
And we have this guitar player who's great. He's only been with us a few times, but literally at sound check, seems fine. Everyone seems fine.
Uh-huh.
But we're all, people are giving us stuff to try, moonshine. And I mean, there was a lot of substances going around, but everyone, again, cool, seemed fine. All of a sudden, I look over during our first song and he is like, not okay.
Oh, no.
He's like, almost like kind of like wandering the stage and just playing loud feedback on his guitar. Like,
oh, no.
Like a Nirvana, like breakdown.
On purpose?
Off of like In Bloom. I don't know what it was. It was like, oh, maybe he's just sort of like feeling it tonight or trying some stuff. And he is a little more of the rock and roll, you know, side of our band. But it just started to be not musical. It was just like he was just blasting various sounds over our horn section and stuff. And then I look back, he's like hugging the drummer. He's like literally sitting on the drum riser and like resting his head on my amp. Like,
oh boy.
And then eventually he like was like almost collapsing and they took him off stage. They're just like, all right, we got to help this guy out. And we were like, I guess we're going to keep playing. It was the first couple songs of our set, 75 minute set, you know, and he was just like out, and he doesn't remember anything of that night. Like he like woke up the next day. He's totally fine. And to this day, we don't know if someone did like drop something in his moonshine or like, but we all had the same stuff and we felt fine.
Some strong stuff, man. You got to be careful with that Kentucky moonshine, dude. We've had experiences there too.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Sandy little pasture rolling like a wave in the middle. A pony in the sunset will break your pretty heart just a little. Never left, and I put the papers back inside.
The song of Alpenglow, Burlesque Desert Window, feels like a party that's simmering in the back of an old saloon, you know, like about to go off the rails.
I like that.
How did that song come together?
That one was like a really fun. I wrote that before I had a melody for it, which is kind of unique for me. Normally, my writing process generally is I kind of mess around on a guitar or piano or something, and I come up with a little melody, and then that kind of sparks the idea for a song. But that one was almost started as, well, part of it started as a little poem I was working on. And then it just kind of like scattered off from there. And, you know, it's a little bit vague and random lyrically, which is, I wanted it to be. Just, you know, I was like working on interesting, what I thought of as interesting turns of phrase, kind of a synopsis of like a psychedelic experience a little bit, but that was just the basis of it. It was more just like a lyrical exercise, I guess, than anything.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase isotonic freezer, honey, you can feel me die. Yeah. And it gets in the breeze, we're silhouetted by the fire. Feels like something was taken around that campfire.
Jeff was like, what's an isotonic freezer? And I said, I don't know. It sounded good together at the time, you know, which I like. We're loosening up and writing like that a lot. And I think a lot of my favorite writing is like that too, where sometimes it's, you know, not every line has to be some deep, meaningful.
Blankets in the breeze, we're silhouetted by the fire.
Have you ever woken up from a dream with a song?
Yeah, yes, and I've missed it before too, where I've woken up and written lyrics down and gone back to bed, and I've also woken up with song like what I thought was a new song in my head from a dream, and then just gone back to bed without doing anything about it and losing it forever. Sleep in a hotel though is keep a pad of paper next to the bed in case I wake up with a joke in my mind. And then if I forget to put the pad of paper there, I just convince myself that that joke wasn't that funny. I go back to sleep, you know? So I think that if you're like, I go through phases of being available to that. I feel like more so, I feel like if you make yourself available to always being ready to catch those things, you could probably get some good stuff.
You have kids, right?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. I have an 11-year-old daughter, a 9-year-old son, and an 8-year-old stepdaughter.
At a certain point, you were going through what I'm going through right now of sleeping kind of, but not really. My daughter's about 8 and a half months.
Oh yeah. You're in the shit, man.
And she recently had a nice little 5-6 day stretch where every night she was sleeping from like 7:30 to like 6. She was sleeping through the night.
Pretty great. Yeah.
And
yeah, you got used to that, didn't you?
Oh yeah, and then last few nights back up at 2 a.m.
Back, damn it, yeah.
New
yeah,
teeth coming in. Sure. But during those few days when we actually were sleeping, all of a sudden these Technicolor dreams started happening for me and my wife.
Like, really?
Most of the time, I feel like I don't remember my dreams, or they'll come in like spurts. Yeah, like all this, because your brain, I think, was so starved for like extended REM. REM, you know, yeah. That like it was like, ooh, let's go on a wild ride through
kind of a nice
the sea and the mountains, you know.
Right.
You have a song called Quitting is Rough on the new record. I mean, quitting smoking, if you're a chain smoker, it's got to be pretty hard. Like, what was the process? Did you have hypnosis? Like, what was the main thing that got you through it?
No. Well, I had a partner that quit with me, which is probably the biggest help. But I also, I've just gotten like sick and I couldn't get better. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the impetus, you know. It was one of those things that just hung around, and I could tell I wasn't doing myself any favors, you know, being on the road and smoking a pack a day. And so it was just time. But you said, like that, you mentioned John Prine before, that his last record, When I Go to Heaven, I'm going to have a smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I empathize with that. Yeah, for sure. See the stars up high above. Love me with the painless love. Someone might pull the rug out any minute. Jack and Lucy eating two. Two from me and one from you. I don't know just what I'd do without it. Yeah, quitting is rough, you know it is. Come and show me what I missed. Fly around, fly around, fly around, fly around. It's such a disconnect because everyone knows how deadly this thing is, right? Right.
And it's a part of our culture in movies and TV. It's available at every single gas station and 7-Eleven and everywhere right. You go, as long as you're 18. And it's like on the pack, like this thing will kill you.
It's an amazing thing. Really.
And we're like, no. We'll take another
yeah,
one.
Yeah, but not yet. It'll kill me later. That's yeah. The thing. And it's also not 100% death rate. You know, we all know the story about, oh yeah, my great grandma, I had one. You know, she's smoking since she was like 95. And that didn't kill her. Just time got her, you know? And so it's like, we all know that. So I think it's like a credit card, you know? It's like, I don't have to pay for it now.
Right.
So it seems fine. And now everybody that smokes from the young assumes they'll quit at some point, I think. You know, but which is one of those things. You know, I feel like we work in one of the last businesses where it's still very prevalent. You know, we just played a festival this weekend, and I got off stage, and everybody's smoking. And like, who else goes to the office or whatever, and everybody's still going on smoke breaks, you know? It's like we were kind of the last group of people that are still doing that. And so it's not an easy thing to not do it, but I feel, you know, it's incredible how much I feel, like how better I feel.
Yeah, going through these rural towns in Kentucky this last weekend, we stopped at a gas station and you walk in, everyone's smoking inside playing slot machines.
Yeah.
And like your eyes are like burning trying to pay for your chips. And
we were playing shows where every bar we played was smoking, you know?
Yeah.
Every night was like that. And so it's changed in my lifetime. It was when I was a kid, it was completely acceptable for parents to smoke in the house. To where now it's like the devil, you know.
Right.
It's gone. It's a real culture shift in a real short amount of time. So there's definitely always, you know, there's going to be some outliers still. I kind of respect them for it.
Do you remember the last song that you wrote on a like smoking binge? Like, is it like a line where it's like, nope, everything past this song is post smoking?
Yeah, there were a couple of the songs. Let's see. I quit smoking a year and a half ago, so it hasn't been that long. So I'd say about half the songs on this record
were that was pretty recent. Yeah.
Smoking. Yeah. I used to go, my favorite place, I had like this little hideout in Duluth. It's called it's gone now, but it was called the Voyager Inn. It was this great little motel downtown. And it's from a different time, you know, like outdoor entrance motel right by a couple great bars that I like a lot. And you could smoke in the rooms. And I'd go on little writing nights there all the time. And I was probably one of my more productive times in my life. Really, I'd go stay there and just write, see some friends and write some songs, you know, and that place is gone now. And that kind of that whole method is gone now. So it's all right. Like it all comes in phases, you know, and I feel like I've been just as productive without it. I was definitely chewing up a lot of toothpicks in the studio after I quit smoking them.
What is the decision? Is there a decision, I guess, to stay without a drummer as you expand in popularity? Sure. You can add at any time, but I think it sometimes takes away the purity of the string sound, maybe.
We've played with a drummer a few times, live and early in studio. There's a couple of songs on our album Trouble that our friend played drums on. And we've done it live too, and it's been fun, but again, it completely changes the feel.
Right.
All of a sudden, there is this kind of metronome on stage where we are so used to our tempo is really flowing with each other.
Shaking leaves and empty frame. You left without warning in the pouring rain. I tear apart and look inside. Your poems and polish ain't no way to hide.
Thankfully, we are able to keep, you know, it rarely clashes with us. Once in a while, it'll fall apart. But we've just been playing with each other for so long that we have an idea of a tempo of a song, and it moves, you know, the chorus might be a couple of BPMs faster than the verse, and it will happen every time. And then when we've had a drummer up there who's actually like a really good drummer, like, oh, it's straight now. And it doesn't feel right, kind of, you know? There's nothing more fun than playing electric guitar in front of a drum kit. It's still one of my favorite things to do in the world. I love playing with drummers. But with this band in particular, the times that we've done it haven't been like, oh, I like this better. It's just been, feels off for us a little bit. That being said, creatively, if we really wanted to add a drummer, I'm sure we'd get used to it. It's just exposure, you know. But at the moment, we all just kind of like how we have it. It's just like a bunch of weirdos, you know, that can kind of hear each other's brains tick a little bit.
They ripped up the streets in old Duluth, a violent reminder of an older truth. Nothing's the same. How could it be? When I'm not the devil that I used to be.
Have you ever had that moment where you feel like you're going to be really sick in the middle of a show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a kind of, for us, like a notorious food poisoning show where people kept dropping like flies during the set. But at the end, it was just me and Eric and our banjo player left. but like our fiddle player was sick before. And then just during the show, I remember Timmy looking at me and be like, I got to get off the stage. And they're throwing up in a trash can on the wings, you know. Yeah, it's happened. I've had it myself as well. It's not great, man.
When Alpenglow comes out end of October, if you had the ability to play this record start to finish in any venue, anywhere in the world, where would it be? And you can make a bill with three other bands with you.
Oh my God. Okay.
Who would those bands be?
Well, I think, where would I play this start to finish? I feel like we've played so many really beautiful outdoor venues. But when I think of a show like intentionally made like that, I feel like I'd like to go inside. I don't know. It's like a weather thing, maybe, just so I have control over it. But That being said, I think I would, I think I'd go outside. One of my new favorite places that we've started to play is this really beautiful amphitheater outside of Missoula, Montana, called the Kettle House Amphitheater.
Yeah.
In these mountains, right in front of the Black River, it's a very idyllic, beautiful place. So let's go there. No offense, Red Rocks. I mean, that's always incredible. But go there, and because we probably like to have Jeff sit in and we love the band, I'd say Wilco.
Okay.
We'll be one of them. Because we were talking about Low before and they're one of my favorite bands, I'd say Low would be another one. And then third band, let's go Dust Bowl Revival, man. That sounds like a great show.
You know, we love being the third opener, you know. Yeah. Actually, now you're making me feel bad because we turned down a show opening for Lake Street Dive at that amphitheater.
Heck yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
because it was supposed to be there. It was supposed to be in Bozeman, and then things got
moved.
Weird because of COVID. They wanted to make it outside, which was fair, but we couldn't change our flight, so everything got super messed up.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you will play there, but when you do it, like, think of this conversation, but it's a really great place.
That would be really fun. Take us out with the song Starting Over and where that song came from.
That came from, is it, that one is, as opposed to like Burlesque Desert Window, this one felt very literal for me. The description of a large change in life or a new start, whether that's moving to new town, you know, a divorce, a new job, just something like that, and being intimidated going into it and then finding out that it's actually a great thing. It happens to be an awesome thing for you to do once in a while, I feel like. I think that's where that came from.
Well, keep up the good work, man. This record is really beautiful.
Thank you very much, dude. Thanks for doing this podcast. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, man. We'd love to team up one of these days.
Likewise. Absolutely.
All right, man.
All right.
Later. Heart to heart, burn it to the ground. Make the beds and go to work. Fall to pieces, have you heard? Really breaking, full of nerve. Let's get out of town. Oh, it's draining, change of pace. Hasty visions, hide your face. Don't let go, don't let go. Man, that song sounds good. Give it up for Dave Simonette of Trampled by Turtles. Thanks to him and his team for making this happen. TrampledByTurtles.com is the website. They have a lot of awesome tour dates coming up, including Webster Hall in New York, November 10th, November 11th at the House of Blues in Boston, November 12th at the State Theater in Portland, and all over the place. Their newest record, produced by Jeff Tweedy, is called Alpenglow on 30 Tigers. And if you go to our mothership, thebluegrasssituation.com, Trampled by Turtles are the artists of the month. If you're curious what my group Dust Bowl Revival is up to coming up, well, we have a show in Viroqua, Wisconsin this weekend. Yes, at the Temple Theater. Looking forward to that, playing with Jim Lauderdale. His episode just aired last week. And as always, if you go to theshowontheroad.com/episodes, you can hear all 120 of our interviews. And the YouTube channel has some full interviews that you can watch with our faces involved. Dust Bowl Revival will be playing in California a few different places in December. We just announced a Holiday Hoedown show December 18th at the Venice West, just down the road from me here. It's going to be a lot of fun. Ray Zaragoza is joining us on December 18th there. December 16th at Pappy and Harriet's in Pioneertown out in Joshua Tree, and up in the Bay December 11th at the Chapel in San Francisco, and December 10th at Morro Bay's The Siren. If you still listen to terrestrial radio, old school, blasted in your car radio like I do, 88.5 FM, KCSN, the SoCal Sound, on Sundays, you could hear this very voice coming out over the airwaves. Yes, I have a brand new show called the Sway Out West Radio Hour. It's very exciting. I've always wanted to do this since I was a little kid. 7 a.m., you can tune in and listen to some sweet jams and little snippets of past interviews of this very podcast. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are a part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, stay warm, and we'll see you on the trail.
Don't let go.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.